SBS Audio is supported by advertising.
If you're a facilities manager at a warehouse and your HVAC system goes down, it can turn up the heat, literally. But don't sweat it, Grainger has you covered. Grainger offers over a million industrial-grade products for all your operations, including warehouse HVAC maintenance. And even better, they offer access to experts and fast delivery, so you and your warehouse can both keep your cool. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
SBS, a world of difference. You're with NITV Radio, on mobile, online and on radio.
We acknowledge the traditional owners of the land NITV Radio broadcasts from. The Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation and their elders past and present. We also acknowledge all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander tribes and clans we broadcast to, from the mountains to the plains, from the desert to the sea, from fresh water to salt water.
Yama, and welcome to NITV Radio. Bertrand Tungandami Ngaya. I'm Bertrand Tungandami. Coming up in your program this Monday, the 30th of September. Like every Monday afternoon, we'll bring you current affairs stories from an Indigenous perspective, shared with us by NITV's Nula program. Also in the program today, we look at a healing ceremony held last week in Darwin for three US Marines who were killed when their aircraft crashed on the Tiwi Islands last year. We also meet Jessica Staines of the Cori Curriculum, a consultancy program that seeks to support educators celebrate Aboriginal culture in their teachings and practice. All these stories and the very best of black music after the latest news.
Australia Day 1972 saw the first Aboriginal embassy erected outside Parliament.
The native title legislation must be amended.
And they've walked this land so many times before anybody came.
I am sorry.
In this bulletin, a parliamentary inquiry told Indigenous economic empowerment key to closing the gap. The man jailed for kidnapping 4-year-old Cleo Smith fails in bid to reduce his sentence, and warnings of visa cancellations for those who indicate support for a terrorist organization. The Closing the Gap targets and framework can be further improved by supporting the economic development and self-determination of First Nations Australians. Of the 17 national socioeconomic targets, only 5 of the targets are on track to be met and 4 are worsening. Yawuru Man Professor Peter Yu is the Vice President of the First Nations Portfolio at the Australian National University. He has told a parliamentary inquiry that economic empowerment needs to be a key focus.
Those percentages of land assets, we have very little capability in our corporations. That's emerging, but in our prescribed body corporates, who are the regulatory bodies holding native title in trust, have very little resources in terms of being able to adequately interface and participate with third-party interests, seek to access and use their lands for economic development. How do we move towards looking at equity propositions rather than program dollars? Because that hasn't worked.
The man jailed for kidnapping 4-year-old Cleo Smith from a campsite in Western Australia has lost an appeal that sought to reduce his sentence. Terence Darrell Kelly was sentenced to 13 and a half years in jail for abducting Cleo at the Blowholes campsite about 70 kilometres north of Carnarvon in the early hours of October 16, 2021, as her parents slept. Cleo was missing for 18 days before finally being found by police alone in a room at a property in Carnarvon on the 3rd of November. Her kidnapping by the 37-year-old sparked one of the biggest police searches in WA history and made headlines worldwide. In February, Kelly's lawyers argued in WA Court of Appeal that the sentence was manifestly excessive. In a hearing that lasted less than a minute this morning, the appeal against the sentence was rejected unanimously. The federal opposition leader Peter Dutton says it's an absolute outrage that there were no arrests or visa cancellations following protests in Sydney and Melbourne over the weekend as part of the National Day of Action for Gaza. The majority of protesters across Australia brought Lebanese and Palestinian flag to the protests, but there were a small group of attendees in Melbourne and Sydney carrying flags representing Hezbollah. Hezbollah, along with Hamas, is considered a terrorist organization by the governments of Australia, the United States and the United Kingdom, along with the EU. Victoria Police says any referrals on prohibited symbols relating to terrorism, which is a Commonwealth offence, will be passed on to the Australian Federal Police. In a statement, Home Affairs Minister Tony Burke says visa cancellations could follow for those who seek to incite discord in Australia, adding that any indication of support for a terrorist organisation is unequivocally condemned. Speaking on ABC Radio National Breakfast, opposition spokesperson for Foreign Affairs, Simon Birmingham, says the death of Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah is not something to be mourned.
No, but we should remember always that Hezbollah is a terrorist organisation, that Nasrallah was a terrorist responsible for leading an organisation that had killed many. Of course, his death is not something to be mourned, and the scenes we saw in protests around Australia, and particularly in Melbourne and Sydney yesterday, were reprehensible and disgusting scenes that clearly deserve strong action from the Albanese government.
Islamic Council of Victoria President Adel Salman says those waving Hezbollah flags at Sunday's protests were a minority, and the vast majority of the Muslim community in Victoria and around Australia are supporting Lebanese people. The Israeli military says it killed Nabil Kaouk, a high-ranking Hezbollah official, in a strike in a southern Beirut suburb. Hezbollah confirmed his death, making him the seventh senior Hezbollah leader slain in Israeli strikes in a little over a week. The announcement came a day after Hezbollah confirmed the killing of leader Hassan Nasrallah. A wave of Israeli airstrikes across large parts of Lebanon has killed at least 1,030 people, including 156 women and 87 children, in less than 2 weeks, according to Lebanon's health ministry. In the town of Tyre, in southern Lebanon, Sausan Halawi is helping to dig graves to bury six family members killed by Israeli airstrikes.
We still have people under the rubble. An elderly man, a 70-year-old woman, a 90-year-old man. All those martyred are women and children, and a Lebanese army member, his parents, his sister-in-law, and his brother were martyred.
Hundreds of thousands of people have been driven from their homes in Lebanon by the latest strikes. The Lebanese government estimates that around 250,000 are in shelters, with 3 to 4 times as many staying with friends or relatives or camping out on the streets. Patients are paying more to see the GP despite incentive payments for bulk billing being tripled. The Royal Australian College of GPs Health of the Nation survey found 1 in 4 doctors are bulk billing more consults after the Albanese government increased funding. But the report card reveals patients' out-of-pocket costs rose to $36.86 on average for a 20-minute consult in 2024, up from $34.91 in 2023 as inflation hits the health sector. Nicole Higgins is the president of the Royal Australian College of GPs. She says the findings show the need to address the underfunding of Medicare and make healthcare more affordable for all Australians. Firefighters in New South Wales say they're prepared for the bushfire season, which officially starts today, Monday, the 30th of September. Property owners are being urged to do their part to lower the fire risk by taking steps such as clearing debris and leaves from gutters, trimming overhanging trees, removing materials such as mulch and flammable liquids, and preparing a hose that will reach around the property. Residents also being reminded to stay up to date with alerts using the Rural Fire Service Hazard Near Me app and the local radio station. The Commissioner of the RFS, Rob Rogers, says it is also important to have a bushfire plan to keep your family safe.
We need to prepare ourselves for what's coming. The state is in a good position. We're in a good position as far as resourcing. We've got a lot of resources, fire services. We've got our large air tanker, Mareeba Shear, that's coming back in the next week from California. Whether you're going to stay or go, if your home is prepared, then it gives firefighters a lot better chance to save your home. You want to make sure that obviously you and your family are the most safe as they can be, so have that discussion.
1,000 Qantas engineers have walked off the job in a protest over negotiations over pay. The two-hour strike this morning involved staff at major airports in Brisbane, Sydney, Canberra, Melbourne, Adelaide and Perth. Union members are pushing for a 15% pay rise in the first year of a new enterprise agreement, followed by 5% increases in subsequent years. A spokesperson for Qantas says contingencies were put in place to minimise the impact of the strike on travellers' plans. The National Secretary of the Australian Manufacturing Workers Union, Steve Murphy, says the wages of engineers have been frozen for years and that needs to change.
And we've seen on Thursday and today the workers starting to take to the streets to demonstrate to Qantas that they have had enough. They've had enough of Qantas's greed, Qantas's approach to always to on the take, but never been able to give. We've seen Qantas have ghost flights, and we've seen them refresh their fleet, and none of it is coming back to the workers. It's about time that Qantas showed these workers that they are valued, they are respected, and that they paid them right.
And to sport in cricket, Australia's captain Mitch Marsh says the 3-2 win against England in the one-day international series has allowed the talent of some of the younger players to be showcased. Out with a sore back, Marsh held both the calmness of his injury hit team and the excellence of stand-in skipper Steve Smith. The team's next assignment is a three-match ODI series against Pakistan on home soil, which gets underway in early November. Marsh says the team is riding high on this latest win, with the spotlight too on the younger players.
I don't think it's right to name the next future superstar, but we've certainly invited a lot of young guys. Cooper Connolly playing his first game. Jake Fraser-McGurk got a go in the T20s. Aaron Hardy was outstanding, so I think across the board, it's always great when you see young guys come in and I guess most importantly, hopefully they really enjoyed playing cricket for Australia.
And now having a look at the weather around the country, Broome mostly sunny, 38 degrees, sunny in Perth and a top of 23, possible shower in Adelaide with a top of 20, Melbourne, partly cloudy day, 19 degrees, Hobart, partly cloudy as well and 19, Albury-Wodonga, sunny, 19 degrees, mostly sunny in Canberra with a top of 21, showers easing in Wollongong with a top of 19, same forecast for Sydney with 20 degrees, showers in Newcastle, 22 degrees, Brisbane, a shower 2 and 29. Townsville, mostly sunny day, 30 degrees. Cairns, sunny and 31. Alice Springs, mostly sunny, 26. Darwin, sunny day, 36 degrees. And the Torres Strait Islands, mostly sunny day and a top of 32 degrees. And that is NITV Radio News.
TV Radio, Monday, Wednesday, Friday at 1 p.m. or anytime online.
Blue, oh Miss Lady, Blue.
That was Lady Blue by Emery Waramara. I'm Bertrand Tungandame and you're listening to NITV Radio, coming to you from Nam on the Kulin Nation this Monday afternoon. Still to come in your program, we look at a healing ceremony held last week in Darwin for three US Marines who were killed when their aircraft crashed on the Tiwi Islands last year. As you'll hear, during the ceremony, members of the Marines' families were adopted into the Tiwi Mantiupi clan. On NITV Radio today, we also meet Jessica Staines of the Koori Curriculum, a consultancy program that seeks to include First Nations culture in early childhood education. But first, some current affairs stories from an Indigenous perspective, brought to us by NITV's NOLA program. A group of Aboriginal police officers in the Northern Territory have lodged a racial discrimination complaint against the NT government and police commissioner. Met with the Australian Human Rights Commission, they are claiming damages for more than two decades of racial discrimination over pay and conditions. Emma Kellaway reports.
In this landmark legal challenge, Aboriginal police officers have detailed allegations of racial vilification against them and others in the community. Lawyers for the group say they've spoken to up to 20 Aboriginal community police officers to file the complaint.
Casual racism was meted out to officers on a daily basis. They were basically treated as a separate and second-class group of police officers within the force.
Now seeking to be compensated for those actions and for disparities in pay.
ACPOs are on paper limited to certain duties, but in practice they do a lot of the work that constables do, and yet they're not remunerated for that work.
It comes just months on from an apology by the NT Police Commissioner for past harms and injustice, along with commitments to eliminating racism within the force. In a statement, he said the complaint is a positive step for NT Police, that members have the confidence to speak up about issues such as racism. We are invested in cultural reform and continuing to make progress for a safe workplace. Meanwhile, the newly elected NTCLP government has responded by reiterating commitments to bolstering police powers. My focus for the NT Police Force is on its future and making sure our hard-working force has the support, resources and powers it needs to keep Territorians safe. The complaint will now go through a process of conciliation. The group say if it's unsuccessful, they will seek to file a class action with the federal court.
There was a report by Emma Kellaway. Now, the inspirational journey of four footy hopefuls from the Tiwi Islands has been recorded in a new documentary. The film, Like My Brother, follows four young women over 6 years as they travel between the Top End and NAM, Melbourne, in their pursuit of careers in the AFLW. Chris Elena reports.
From the Tiwi Islands to big city Melbourne, four young women chasing their dreams, hoping to make their mark on the AFLW.
TV boys and men have had the opportunity. Now it's our turn. We get to show them what our skills can do.
Their journey captured in a landmark documentary.
We got Brandon Major coming out with a few Essendon ladies and to do a trial. And, yeah, so we went down and had a go. And that's where it all started from.
Like My Brother, from filmmakers Sal Belhari and Laricha and Warramunga woman Danielle McLean, had its world premiere at the Melbourne International Film Festival last month.
It was pretty hard at first, like, you know, leaving home and coming to a big city like this, you know, never experienced anything living at a remote community. We knew we're going to face some times, you know, that are tough, and we had to get confident.
The documentary follows the journey of Rena, Jess, Freda and Juliana over 6 years as they travel to footy training camps in Melbourne, chronicling their journey from island life to elite sport.
Knowing you're leaving home, but you're leaving for one of the best situations, you know. Some will flourish, some might find it a little bit harder.
Showcasing Tiwi culture was of the utmost importance to the filmmakers.
They were so generous and the culture was so beautiful, and to be able to go along to a Pukamani ceremony and have the family support that, to film that as part of the film, was absolutely sensational. I mean, I think that's a really moving part of the film.
Fresh off local film festival circuits, the documentary will have its nationwide premiere next month. Chris Eleanor, NITV News.
An overhaul of the school curriculum in New South Wales will make it mandatory for students to learn about First Nations experiences of colonisation. Aboriginal educators say it will introduce truth-telling and balance to the lessons of history. NITV reporter Ricky Kirby visited a school to discuss the changes with students and teachers.
At Ford Street High School in Sydney's inner west, these students are taught about the history of colonisation, but it's not a set part of the curriculum.
It was mandated in the overview that students would spend probably one or two lessons looking at first contact. It wasn't very prescriptive, so it was really on the teacher to decide what that dot point meant. Actually, the new syllabus is much more prescriptive, and it tells teachers exactly what they should be teaching.
In a few years, students in years 7 to 10 will study the impact that missions, reserves and stations had on the lives of Aboriginal people, the study of frontier conflict across the country, and the role of religious organisations will also be compulsory.
The curriculum overhaul, so to speak, takes political ideology out of it. It's around truth-telling. You know, we can't move forward as a nation unless both sides of the stories are told. And it can be done in a balanced way.
It's a change welcomed by students as well.
There's rich culture to celebrate and there's history to unpack and there's so much more that we can understand, and I think it's so important that everybody has that understanding.
I think it's really important. I think especially in history, where we're learning about perspectives and we're learning about the value of different people's perspectives and understanding things, I think it's important that students learn the facts from early on.
No, I'd like to know a lot more, and I feel like this curriculum will definitely do a lot more for other people to learn more.
Schools will have the next 2 years to plan and prepare to teach the new syllabus before it's fully rolled out across New South Wales in 2027.
Ultimately, we're going to be working together in groups of teachers, pooling resources, conducting research, and that will enable us to plan.
Lessons of the past to prepare for the future. Ricky Kirby, NITV News.
The founder of a program that uses the healing power of horses to support the mental health and emotional well-being of Aboriginal young people in WA's Kimberley region has been named as one of the winners in this year's Australian Mental Health Prize. Ricky Kirby has the details.
It's described as a culturally grounded alternative to conventional therapies, focused on the healing power of horses. Yarrindi Junga, which means horses helping in the Yaru language, was born out of the need to respond to community concerns over youth social and emotional well-being in a place where suicide rates are far higher than the rest of the country.
A lot of the kind of programs that are offered in communities are often just been adapted out, you know, from a westernised model, whereas this has really been developed up in a entirely Aboriginal worldview. So I think it's a very unique offering in that it's a lot more holistic.
Good boy. Come on.
The program fosters trust, connection and empowerment among Aboriginal young people, providing a safe space for control and self-reflection.
A horse sees you just for exactly what you offer in the present moment. There's no judgment, there's no carrying yarns. There's nothing that's preconceived except that moment in time when you're in the space with the horse. So it's a really genuine offering.
It's an initiative founded in 2019 by Aboriginal researcher Professor Julie Coffin. Her work recognised this week in the Australian Mental Health Prize.
I think it's amazing to be on the other side of the country and to have received this type of acknowledgement. And I think it's really about the whole team as a collective, and that, you know, to be the representative of our team, it's very humbling.
Over 2,000 young people aged between 6 and 26 have gone through the program.
The piece that always gets me is that we can change the way someone feels about himself in the world, you know, and that is the hard work. It's long and it's slow, and it's really being able to hold space for someone in a way that they can connect with. And so, you know, I see this work as just it's invaluable, you know, for our young people and where they're at.
The program runs in Broome and Derby, with plans to expand to Fitzroy Crossing and Halls Creek. But Professor Coffin hopes it can be replicated in other parts of the country too. Ricky Kirby, NITV News.
And that's all for Current Affairs Stories, brought to us by NITV's NOLA program. We must now step aside for a break, but when we come back, well, stay tuned, because when we come back, we'll be looking at a traditional healing ceremony held last week in Darwin for the families of three U.S. Marines who died during a training exercise over the Tiwi Islands in the Northern Territories.
Visit sbs.com.au/NITV Radio.
In 2025, SBS will offer three cadetship positions, including one identified placement for an Aboriginal and or Torres Strait Islander candidate, culturally and financially supported by NITV, National Indigenous Television. All successful cadets participate in the same program of training and work experience. And that was Mariuna by Baker Boy, also featuring Yirma. Mariuna actually means to dance, purely for the fun of it, as opposed to ceremonial or celebratory dance.
Join the conversation on radio, online and mobile. You're with NITV Radio.
Now, a traditional healing ceremony has been held in Darwin for the families of three U.S. Marines who died during a training exercise over the Tiwi Islands in the Northern Territory. Around 24 personnel were on board an Osprey aircraft when it crashed on the remote Melville Island north of Darwin in August last year. Kerr Haynes reports.
It was a moment of healing for families a long way from home. A healing ceremony has been held in honour of the US Marines who died in a Melville Island Osprey crash last year. The Tiwi people have gathered to conduct the final ceremonies of sorry business. Tiwi traditional owner Jennifer Ullangara Clancy says it's a commemoration of the lives lost on their land.
It was the community from the three community brothers and Marble Island wanted this to happen to respect the family because of that he said the last goodbye to the loved ones.
It's been just over a year since the Osprey aircraft carrying 23 service personnel went down on Melville Island while taking part in an Australian Defence Force training exercise. The Osprey aircraft has a checkered safety history with more than 50 related fatalities recorded, but an investigation has ruled out any mechanical failure of the aircraft in this instance, attributing the crash to human error. Now each Marine has been given a Tiwi name in a ceremonial adoption of their families into Tiwi culture.
I've given a name to Brother Rokatarimi.
We've never experienced anything like this before, and it's just so welcoming, and we are all one. We're all human beings, and we cherish this very, very much.
The lives lost include 21-year-old Corporal Spencer Collar, the crew chief, the pilot, Captain Eleanor LeBeau, who was 29, and their highly decorated Major, 37-year-old Tobin Lewis. Jennifer Clancy says their families will now travel to the Tiwi Islands for a final ceremony, the Pukamani.
We share with them and, you know, like, let go so they can have their free, you know, say good. Last goodbye to their own loved ones, because they haven't said goodbye since the day it happened, because they didn't do it in their home, they did it in Australia's soil. That's why my people wanted to do this back home.
Corporal Spencer Collart's mother, Alexia Collart, says it's a closing chapter as they carry on the memory of their loved ones, now forever bonded with the Tiwi people.
I know he would love this, and I know that he is going to be on his way. We've had many signs from him, and we miss him so, so much. He was only 21 years old.
Kira Hain, SBS News.
Your community, your conversation. NITV Radio.
We must now step aside for another break, but stay with us because when we come back, we have a conversation with the founder of the Curriculum, a consultancy program that seeks to support educators celebrate Aboriginal culture in their pedagogy, program and practice. Make sure you get the full picture, not just what the social media feed gives you. Find all our news and stories at SBS Language website. Bookmark sbs.com.au/language in your web browser today.
NITV Radio, on radio, online and mobile.
The CRI Curriculum is a multiple award-winning Aboriginal early childhood consultancy that is offering a range of professional development programs and workshops for educators. The aim is to help guide the inclusion of Aboriginal perspectives in early childhood curriculums. The CRI Curriculum is operated by a Wiradjuri woman and early childhood educator herself, Jessica Staines. Jessica has over 15 years of experience working in the field. Among others, she took part in the World Forum Foundation's Global Leaders Program, and she later became the national representative for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. Jessica also became the Aboriginal Early Childhood Advisor for TV's Play School. In 2021, Jessica became part of the IATSIS Education Advisory Committee and the HIPPIE Reference Group, where she continues to support the development of resources and programs that support Aboriginal children and families in the early years. And Jessica Staines is now joining us on NITV Radio. Hello, Jessen, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Our pleasure. Can you please first tell us who your people are and where you come from?
Yeah, sure. So my family is originally from Molonglen Park, so the Wiradjuri Nation. But for four or five generations, family's been in Gadigal country, which is Sydney, and I live on Darkinyong country, which is the New South Wales central coast. So we've been around our family. We're spread out now across a pretty wide area. And the CURI curriculum is an Aboriginal early childhood consultancy, and essentially we support early childhood educators to include cultural perspectives respectfully in their day-to-day curriculum and planning.
That was actually my first question. If we can talk about the inclusion of Aboriginal perspectives, so what can we imagine? How does it look like in practice?
Yeah, so it's multifaceted, and we tend to use three things. So Aboriginal pedagogy, where we teach through culture and traditional teaching practices rather than about culture. So looking at oral storytelling, for example, or connecting to country with our curriculum planning. The second way is that we include cultural perspectives in topics of inquiry or in children's interests. So it's not tacked on and separate, but it's just a part of everything that we do. So really looking holistically at how we can include culture in context. And the third way is that we create culturally inclusive play spaces and environments. So we're aiming not to have a cultural corner where all the Aboriginal resources and puzzles and games and pictures are gathered together like a wing in a museum, but instead looking at how we can have cultural representation in the art area or in dramatic play or in the sand pit and so forth. So it's natural, and it's also, you know, it provides a culturally safe environment for Aboriginal families as well, yeah.
And this is for early childhood education centres, or is it also for maybe older children as well?
Predominantly we work with early childhood educators. I'm an early childhood teacher, so that's my background and qualifications. But we also do work with primary schools occasionally, and OOSH services, so the outside of school hours care, but predominantly early childhood, yeah.
And what has been the response so far?
Look, I think most educators really want to include culture respectfully and meaningfully in their program, but many non-Indigenous educators haven't had a lot of experience. You know, Aboriginal culture and history wasn't included truthfully or holistically in their education. And so a lot of them worry about being offensive or tokenistic and saying and doing the wrong thing. So a lot of educators are becoming more proactive and seeking that professional development and reaching out to organisations like ours where we can support them in building their cultural capacity and confidence. And now we've seen changes to the early years learning framework, where including culture is no longer an optional extra that's based on teachers' enthusiasm, but it's now a requirement. So we're seeing a lot of educators having that catalyst for change that's coming from our curriculum to want to start inquiring about how they can review their practice. But yeah, I think the uptake has been good and it's growing and growing each year.
I'm actually in the process of looking for a daycare or early childhood education for my kid, and it's quite overwhelming. So how would I know if the centre has worked with you? Is there a way to tell?
Not that they've worked with me, but there are definitely some things that I would look for if it's, you know, something that you value, the importance of cultural inclusion, is I would ask them if they have a reconciliation action plan with Narragana Wali, which is through Reconciliation Australia, which outlines their commitment and, you know, goals and actions that they're hoping to achieve and work towards in their Aboriginal program. So for me, that's pretty important. I would look at their centre philosophy to make sure that there's mention of respect for traditional owners, see if they have an acknowledgement of country. I would inquire if they have Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander educators on staff or what their partnerships look like with their local community. If they're New South Wales based, which is where I am, you know, asking if they're members of their local AECG, which is their Aboriginal Education Consultative Group. So these are all sort of signs and signals that educators are committed, and looking at their enrolment pack, does it make it clear in there to families that reconciliation and the cultural inclusion is important for them? So those are things that I would look for as a parent as to what service I send my child to, yeah.
Thank you so much. And on your webpage, there's a variety of workshops and webinars for educators that you offer. And one that really caught my eye specifically is called Embedding Aboriginal Perspectives for Infants. So who is this one for? Obviously for infants.
Yeah. But I think a lot of early childhood educators really struggle with how to make it meaningful for 0 to 2s. Obviously with older children, we can have discussions and, you know, teach things more directly with them. But for younger children, we don't want to give them washed down preschool experiences and really stay true to where they are at developmentally. For me, you know, it can be simple things like giving them time out on country, that they're developing a relationship with the land, and from that comes a love and innate respect, which will then be scaffolded upon as they move up in the different age groups, to have that respect for the land and the traditional owners. To facilitate relationships with infants, with community members and elders, whether we're having residencies, so relationships and connecting with country is sort of first, and then looking at sensory motor experiences that we can give them. So whether we're looking at having bush tucker gardens that are edible, and we can have, you know, experiences with plants like lemon myrtle, which they can crush and suck and taste and smell, and making it tactile. How we can make Aboriginal art tactile for them, so using coasters and tea towels and having it down at their level rather than up high on the wall at our level. So thinking about what we can do to make culture accessible for them, laying that foundation that we would build upon as they move up in the different age groups in an early learning service.
Mm-hmm. Do you work also with parents, or is it just with the education centres?
It looks like we have a webinar that's for families, which is Embedding Aboriginal Perspectives at Home, and that's vastly based on my 2 children. I've got a 2.5-year-old, and my son's about to turn 1 in a couple of days. So we're talking about how we share our culture at home with our children. So you're welcome to have a look at that. But the other thing, we have a lot of freebies on our website. So we've got show and tell episodes that you can look at, different links to podcasts, like Little Yarns podcast is great for you to listen to in the car with the children, looking at playlists on Spotify. So I'm listening to Alinta and Waveney at the moment. There's some great songs there. Another resource that we have, it's called Shirley Pearl and Her Bush Friends. So it's a letter subscription that you can subscribe to for your children and families, where you get a letter each month that talks about Shirley's adventures on country. That also includes cultural information. So for example, this month was about going down to the river and fishing and finding wallabies and grinding up ochre to make sunscreen and looking at scar trees and so forth. So there's a letter subscription that a lot of families are using as well at the moment.
That's amazing. Who are the people who attend your workshops? Is it more First Nations people, or is it actually non-Indigenous people or educators, I should say?
it just depends. The people that come to our public workshops, mainly they are non-Indigenous people that are wanting to learn and to do better and make those connections. They have lots of questions, and often we're that bridge between their school early learning service and their local community and different organisations. So we refer a lot of people and connect people up. But we also do work with First Nations educators. So last week I was working with Mogo Aboriginal Preschool down in New South Wales South Coast, and we're working with them throughout this year and next year, customising their curriculum in context to their community and doing a lot of community consultations down there. It's just different. The work that we do with Aboriginal preschools tends to be different because they already know about their culture. It's just about looking at ways to transfer that and adapt that into their curriculum, so to speak, whereas the work that we do with non-Indigenous educators can vary because some know nothing about the culture, some know a lot. They're all at different levels. It just depends.
And my last question. Last week, the Koori Curriculum announced the winners of the Koori Curriculum Educator Awards. What is this competition about and who won this year?
The Koori Curriculum Educator Awards has been running for a couple of years now, and it's really to acknowledge leaders within education that are authentically and respectfully embedding Aboriginal perspectives and working in partnership with their local Aboriginal communities. So we have three award categories. So one was First Nations Early Childhood Educator of the Year, which went to Shana Nader. She's an Arenda educator that's working on Kaurna country, and she's doing an amazing job there, really sharing her culture and local culture and bringing that team along on the journey with her. And then we have Primary School Teacher of the Year, and this year that went to Aaron Johnston, who's a principal that's on the Central Coast, which is where I am. He has a Facebook and Instagram account, which is called Mr. J's Learning Space, which I highly recommend teachers that are listening to go and check out and follow him. He's been an amazing ally to First Nations peoples for a very long time. In 2019, I first met him when he participated in the Share the Mic competition, where it was amplifying First Nations voices. And he's also been an ambassador with Wingaru Education and participating in their NAIDOC challenge. So he's amazing. He also has a podcast, which is called the Teacher Takeaway Podcast, where he interviews, you know, First Nations educators often. So Aaron was the Primary School Teacher of the Year, and then we had Ally of the Year, and there were two winners of that. One was Narelle Carhill, who mentors six early learning services on their reconciliation action plans and has developed really beautiful relationships with local elders and been able to authentically embed their perspectives and goals in experiences and in the curriculum at the service. And then there's Kimmy, who's a Maori woman, and she's mentoring 60 early learning services with Greenleaves Education. So there's quite a few of their services that she's working with, and she's really been spearheading reconciliation with them. And they've gone and done, you know, on-country experiences at Uluru and had their directors workshops there and so forth. So I feel like there were four very deserving winners, but we had many, many finalists and nominations this year, which you can still see on our website and read more about these amazing educators, and they're doing an amazing job.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Jess, for taking your time to talk to us on NITV Radio today about Koori Curriculum and the way you guide the inclusion of Aboriginal perspectives into early childhood curriculums.
Oh, thanks for having me. I really appreciate being on. Thank you.
NITV Radio. Share our stories on Facebook.
That was NITV Radio's Sharka Pekova talking to Jessica Staines, childhood educator, advocate and professional speaker and founder of the multi-award-winning Koori Curriculum consultancy program that seeks to celebrate Indigenous culture in early childhood education. Now, some music we sing by Kucha Edwards. And that's all from NITV Radio this Monday afternoon. Thanks for your company today. I'm Bertrand Tungandame, thanking you very much for staying with us. Your program will be back on Wednesday with more stories and news from right across the country. Wishing you a very beautiful afternoon. Till next time, bye for now. Yalu.
Need a few minutes to reset? Great Minds is a podcast from SBS that guides you through different meditation styles from around the world. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.